So once again, welcome to the Alternative Investments Show on Clubhouse. I'm Matthias Knapp. Let me also invite you all to join the Alternative Investments Club. And if you are working with family offices, join also the Family Office Club, which you see at the bottom of my profile on Clubhouse. You can also access all our previous sessions as a podcast called Alternative Investments Clubhouse Sessions. We are on all major podcast players, and we'll also record this session today. So I have with me today Jim Hedges, who is an old friend from the hedge fund world and who became pretty famous in the art world, right? So Jim, maybe give us a quick run through of your career, of your path into the art world, because this is obviously our theme today, art investing with Jim Hedges. And also, yes. why are you famous in the art world? Tell us, Jim.
Well, I don't know that I'm famous anywhere, but listen, Matthias, thank you for having me on. It's always fun to do these sorts of things with you. We've done videos in the past and lots of publications, so it's always good to work together. We have known each other forever. We've known each other since probably the mid-90s, I'm guessing, time at which I was in the fund-of-funds business in the hedge fund and private equity landscape. I started a company that grew out of a family office and helped other families and private banks invest in hedge funds and private equity deals. And I was always one of these people that was very interested in the art world and started buying very modestly when I was young and sort of continued collecting throughout my life. And I also was one of those people that was very bad at separating my professional and my personal lives. I spent a lot of my hobby time in the art world. And as a result, I met a lot of other collectors and people that I was involved in various museums with, who inevitably became clients. So the worlds were actually somewhat conjoined from the get-go. And in fact, selecting an alternative investment manager to me is very analogous work to selecting an artist, because to a certain degree, there is that qualitative and subjective assessment of a set of skills, a contribution and value creation that you look for when you're looking at a hedge fund manager. And I think that, you know, many of those characteristics apply to looking at contemporary artists as well. So after leaving the fund of funds business in 2010.
Let me just insert, you know, for people who are not that familiar with fund of funds and hedge funds, etc. So a fund of fund manager builds portfolios of investment or hedge fund managers where they basically spread the risk, right? And just instead of just putting all your money on one card with one fund, a fund of fund spreads it out, right? And so as Jim said, one of the core competences that you need to have is identifying the right managers, right? And what he's saying is a lot of analogous work to do when doing a right investment in the art world.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. I found that over the years that a lot of the tools that I learned in analyzing alternative investment managers applied to looking at artists, most notably this notion of relative value. I like very much to, I'm happy to jump into an example, but I like very much to look at how an artist's work is priced on a relative basis to his or her peers. You see enormous discrepancies and dislocations in this market when you do that sort of analysis. It's very interesting to see, for instance, that, you know, contemporary masters like Gerhard Richter and Sigmar Polka in Germany, who have had, you know, very, very analogous careers and contributions to the art world, you know, were very differently priced. With Richter works, you know, at the time, maybe, you know, 10, 15 years ago, priced routinely at sort of four times those works of Richter. So I love looking at the disparity of value among artists, but also it's really exciting to look at disparity of value within an artist's own body of work. And this has probably been one of the most enjoyable and fruitful activities that I've done, which is to look across all of the different types of work that an artist makes.
I think you have a really good example for that, right? So let's jump right into, you know, what you have been doing with Warhol.
Yeah, no, that's right. So, you know, I'd been collecting a bit of Andy Warhol's work, and I got to increasingly become familiar with the landscape of who was buying his work, what the different types of works were, whether it was painting, sculpture, photography, works on paper, prints, etc. And I was very attracted to Warhol's photography. He makes these iconic Polaroid photos that are really sort of part of our collective, you know, psyche and you know, the celebrity-driven culture, pop culture that we're familiar with. And I started looking at these works, which are all unique works. In other words, they're one of one, a Polaroid or a black and white photo that he took. They're unique works. And all these photos were a fraction of the cost of the print market, where every print exists times 250. And fundamentally, that made no sense to me, that you could have an object that was a unique thing that was touched by the artist, and it would be a fraction of the cost of something that was made by a machine, really, times 250. So with that thesis, that was sort of the germinal seed of the thesis, I put together a collection of Warhol's photographs. And now I have shifted so that my sort of passion became an investment and has now become a business. And so I'm now working as an art dealer, very different than my former life in the hedge fund landscape. But very fruitful, and you know, a very solid investment that's been great.
Right. Look, when I made the reference earlier, right, about you being famous, I think you're really famous for being the biggest and the most prominent collector of Warhol photos, right? I mean, not even museums, right, can have have the range of and the depth of Warhol photos that you have collected now over the years, correct?
Well, you know, I'm probably, you know, the most active person that's private. I don't know about institutions, but certainly I've been a big advocate for about, you know, nearly 15 years now, really making sure that this work gets understood in terms of its value and appreciated and collected alongside other bodies of work that I think are similarly important. So it's been, you know, as I said, it's been really a gradual transition from impassioned collector to investor to now actually operating a business. But it's a small corner store, but I guess it is my corner store.
Sure. So this show today is really about art investing, right, in general. So tell us, you know, how big is the art world in financial terms?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I think the art world sort of gets a disproportionate amount of press and attention for its size. So they say last year, these numbers are always sort of directionally accurate, but not specifically right. But they say that about 60 billion US of revenues transpired last year, 2020, in the art world. These numbers, I think, are always low that you hear attributed to the size of the art world, because they don't account for so many private transactions, which are never recorded in any format. But that said, you know, the art world was actually overall down about 10% from 2019 in terms of total volume of sales. And of course, that's because physical exhibitions at galleries, art fairs, and live in-person auctions were either, you know, not happening at all or only happening to a small degree compared. But what really picked up a lot of the slack was online. And, you know, everybody has talked about the art world, but the promise of the online art world and being able to purchase easily, you know, with good visibility on provenance and quality and all that kind of stuff and price. But, you know, it was slow going. And last year it went into, you know, super turbocharged mode because people were at home sitting in front of their laptops or on their iPads, and they were scrolling through ArtNet and Artsy and First Dibs and all these different types of online platforms or even gallery websites that have rushed to create online viewing rooms. And that has really exploded on the upside very positively for the art world. And I think that while we will see post-COVID a return to, you know, obviously exhibitions and auctions and all these sorts of things that people relied on in the past, but But I think online is now inextricably cemented as being a big contributor and will only grow in the future because people have seen it can work.
I mean, down 10% only, I think, is the real win, right? I mean, nobody could go to Sotheby's or any of the other big auction houses, right, physically. And so I think that's a big win. So do you see now the preference of these online platforms also drive up prices in art?
You know, I would actually tell you that I think they actually reduce prices because they create disclosure. You know, they create transparency. Typically, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I think that I'm probably typical for a lot of participants. When I have a work to sell, I'm going to put it on all of the platforms that I participate with. So that is to say that, you know, the object, the price, everything is the same on FirstDibs as it is on Artsy, as it is on ArtNet, as it is on a number of others that I work with. And because of that, you know, when you go to search for that thing on the internet, you're frequently going to have it pop, pop, pop. And that transparency is, you know, a price discovery tool, which makes things probably cheaper or at least, you know, more uniform.
Right. So you mentioned a lot of the art market is unregulated, right? Is this now an advantage or a disadvantage?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm generally frustrated, as many people are in the investment world, by regulatory oversight and the costs and burdens that it, you know, hangs on asset managers. And the same is true in the art world. As a headline, the art world is generally unregulated, which is to say that it has characteristics of being not having disclosure requirements, not being very transparent, apart from the online pricing. It has, you know, attributes of being very, very relationship driven. So when I think about those dynamics of being private, unregulated, relationship driven, it feels like 1970s, 1980s private equity. It feels like the early modern days of hedge funds, you know, starting around 1990. Remember, the hedge fund industry around the early 90s was about $40 billion of assets under management, now multi-trillion, but $40 billion. So the art world at $60 billion is, you know, slightly larger, but sort of analogous, and analogous in its privacy, in its relationship focus, and that access and deal flow, again, just like the private equity landscape, is paramount. The best deals or access to the best new artists is apportioned to people who are active participants in the industry. So, you know, I very frequently come across a contemporary artist who's in much demand. And, you know, if you speak to the galleries that represent them, you know, you might have an artist that makes 20 paintings a year, for instance. They may have demand for 800 of those paintings a year. So that creates all sorts of interesting implications in terms of the amount of demand with the mismatched supply and the relationship that enables one to access that material. Again, it's sort of like private equity. You get the deal flow because you're the guy that they want to do the partnership with or the investment with, as opposed to, you know, being the first person to write the check.
So are there some transparent parts of the art world? You already mentioned the platforms, right? That's obviously a part of it, or are there more?
Yeah, well, I mean, the platforms do help transparency, but you know, the auction houses and publicly recorded auction records are really the best tool to use in assessing value. Right. So, for instance, you know, all of the major auction houses, when they conduct a sale, this is part of the regulatory touch point that they have. They are required to report the result. And as a byproduct of that, you know, there are databases out there, many databases, where you can search public auction records to see where similar or, you know, identical works have sold in the past and at what value. So that's helpful, but again, you know, I'm working right now with a Warhol painting that I have on consignment. It's one of about 24 paintings of this subject by the artist. And you look at the public auction records, and basically you have to go back about 15 years to see a few transactions, and they're all sort of irrelevant. So even though there is, in this case, transparency and disclosure about the valuation of what that painting should be or what it has achieved in the past, the reality is that it doesn't really have anything to do with the current market. And so there's always, you know, a set of public and transparent tools that can be relied on, but they'd never really tell the full valuation story.
Right. Yeah, sure. For sure. Yeah, we get that. Now, you know, Warhol is obviously what you would call an investment grade piece of art. So, you know, tell us more about this world of investment grade art. How big is it? How would you describe it? Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because when people speak about investing in art or in the art world, it sounds daunting, it sounds huge, it sounds unwieldy. But, you know, I think of certain artists as being investment grade, such as Warhol. And that is to say that they are artists who have a sufficient body of work to create a market, a sufficient number of buyers and sellers, a sufficient amount of dollar volume. And when you add those things up, you see that artists who have created a sufficiently large body of work supported by a sufficiently large community of buyers and sellers with a certain level of valuation or dollar volume, it's actually a very small list. I mean, relatively speaking to the number of artists out there. You know, I would say that what I characterize as sort of investment grade artists who meet those sorts of criteria number under 500 worldwide. And that's a remarkably small, if you will, you know, universe from which to select to make your investment. Obviously, each of those artists has, you know, a breadth of work. So there are a lot of choices. But, you know, there are lots of non-investment grade. And in fact, most artists and most galleries are selling non-investment grade artwork, which has very limited resale potential, upside potential, etc. But within this sort of, you know, this small world, this demimonde of investment grade, you've got, call it under 500 artists, which you might think of as securities.
How many of those 500 are contemporary and how many are, let's say, dead folks?
Yeah, well, so basically, you know, we speak in terms of contemporaries, which means living artists,
yes,
or sort of the end of the 20th century, and then modern artists, you know, going back to like 1900 and then call it impressionists or other artists before that period. You know, the majority of investment grade artists are going to be second half of the 20th century. So they may or may not be alive now, but you know, that's really the universe that has, you know, been defined and has those characteristics I described before. Obviously, there are lots of older paintings that are very much investment grade and very valuable, but that's a really small universe. You know, like the Dutch or Spanish old masters, you know, kings, those are investment grade artists. But on the other hand, they transact at such low frequency and there are so few participants in those markets that they're not really investment grade per se, even though they may represent a good investment or a good store of value.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Now, I'm wondering, what would be your recommendations? How do you invest in contemporary art?
Well, I mean, there are a number of different paths. Obviously, there are people that have a purely speculative investment approach, and speculative usually has a connotation of also being short term. So, you know, like any investment, assessing the size of the investment you're going to make, the duration of the investment, the liquidity that you need to have in the investment, all those things contribute, no different than investing in public securities. I feel like the opportunity to invest with these sorts of artists, these investment grade artists, is very, very limited. And you can play it two ways. You can do it on the equity side, using sort of a corporate finance analogy. You can do it on the equity side of the balance sheet or on the debt side of the balance sheet. So equity can just be buying a portfolio of art that you believe is going to appreciate in value. And that's usually done with an art advisor or, you know, a gallery that you partner with, or even a private salesperson at an auction house. So that's just outright ownership of the artwork. And then there are different things that you would discuss about portfolio construction and duration and all that stuff. The other opportunity is, and obviously, I'm sorry, within equity investing in our outright ownership, there's also the opportunity to make distressed purchases. And distressed purchases very frequently come about when I speak to people on the debt side of the equation. So there is a very small universe of art lenders who will use your fine art or collectibles as collateral for an asset-based loan. And those lenders charge very, very high rates, generally speaking, typically maybe, 5 to 1,000 basis points over a risk-free rate of return, if not even more. So they're very well compensated to take on collateral that is less liquid than you would typically find with public securities or something. But when people come in looking to borrow money against an artwork or an art collection, very frequently they're distressed sellers. And so sometimes the conversations start off where you're discussing this notion of lending them money against a painting or a group of paintings, but then it very quickly evolves to, well, actually what we'd like to do is sell this stuff. And we want a price today as opposed to a price that we're going to reap from an auction house if we roll the dice and put it at auction and, hope to get paid in 4 to 6 months. So really, these paths are not mutually exclusive, they're complementary. And so if you have the ability to look at buying art, buying distressed assets, or lending money to art collectors, they're very different risk return profiles. And it depends on the artist and the composition of the portfolio. But there are lots and lots of different ways to play it.
So what sort of returns can be expected by investing in the art world?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned before, on the debt side, I think routinely people are achieving investment returns of, call it, 5 to 15% net returns to the investor. Okay. When you're, a Swiss franc based investor with negative real interest rates, 5% looks pretty fantastic, or, fill in the blank. Lots of other people would find that very compelling. Certainly foundations and endowments and institutions find that return level of interest. So I would sort of say that's on the low side. And I would say that if one is looking to make equity investments in the art world, where you do have constrained liquidity and a finite market, and you have to know or be advised to know what you're doing, I'd say that the return hurdles are much, much higher. And I speak in terms of multiples of capital invested as opposed to IRRs, flat percentage rates. So, I think that there are distressed opportunities that I come across, a handful of times a year where one is able to buy, at 5 cents, 10 cents, 20 cents on the dollar, and, make 5 to 10 times one's capital invested. But, it's not for the faint of heart. It's still investment grade. It's still blue chip. It's still, going to do very well and be very secure and represent a safe investment. But, when you see those opportunities, identifying them and being able to pull the trigger quickly is very important. And that is actually a responsiveness is a very big factor in making money in the art world.
So if you want to play in this art world, in the investment grade part of the art world, right, how much money should people take in their hands?
Well, I would say that given the process of having enough capital to buy something that's investment grade and being able to, engage with the resources and sort of manage it, I would think in terms of, $2 to $5 million would be a starting point that I think makes sense. Below that, you're not really building diversification. You're probably, taking some fairly concentrated bets or a fairly concentrated bet. But I believe $2 to $5 million, one can really start to put together something that approximates a portfolio that's part of asset allocation. And that's another aspect that I should speak on. The fact is, art is a huge diversifier. And, I have been in the investment world for long enough, over 30 years, to know that the 500-year flood comes along all the time and all correlations go to one. However, the art world still, to me, looks like an anomaly. It looks like a truly diversifying asset. Art is, in this investment grade universe, art is a global currency. It is a store of value. And as such, there are people that will buy it at times when it seems counterintuitive. You know, some of the biggest buyers of art in the past 20 years have been from currency controlled countries, South Africa, Brazil, China, etc. These are people that view the art world as a surrogate currency and a store of value that represents a demand in the marketplace, which bolsters prices. On the other hand, a lot of times people say, you know, I want to have something that's counter-cyclical. I want to have a real asset play. So the portfolio contribution, the role in one's overall investment portfolio can be, you know, very powerful. And as a result, you know, there are funds that are set up to take in investors' capital. There are art advisors that specialize in advising collectors on building portfolios. But, you know, inevitably, there's always a balance between what one is impassioned by, what one is interested in, what one is comfortable owning, and the investment thesis. So unlike most other investment choices, you know, I can say I want an ESG portfolio. I can say I want, you know, a laddered fixed income muni bond portfolio, whatever. But in the art world, it's different because there is that dynamic of, well, I'm going to have it in my home. Or, it represents a personal subjective taste assessment. It's not necessarily bad, but it's a different dynamic than exists with those things like I just mentioned that are more traditional.
Yeah, for sure. I want to turn to another side of technological evolution that also really has the potential to greatly influence the art world. Right? I'm talking now about, you know, the birth of the blockchain technology, right? Yeah. Things like smart contracts and decentralized autonomous organizations and ICOs, etc., have interesting use cases for artists and the art industry alike, right? For example, blockchain could revolutionize art markets by solving questions of provenance, transparency, yep, copyright, ownership issues. Startups are already building real-world applications on blockchain. Blockchain and smart contracts can also be used by artists to fund their projects, right, through token mm-hmm. sales, creating their own artist coins and using it as a crowdfunding or crowd investment tool, and so on. What is your take on those initiatives? Where does this take us?
Well, you know, you just described the landscape perfectly. I don't know that I can add too much to what you just said. I mean, the way I think of this is it's sort of like 1999 and the internet bubble. Feels like lots of people developing lots of different use cases, lots of different scenarios, lots of different business models. And, you know, what ends up shaking out is utterly impossible to opine upon right now. I mean, I think that there are merits to a lot of the examples that you just listed, but, you know, whether those become, if you will, enduring substantial business models is really, it's too early to tell. And, you know, what happens is we're constantly sort of whipping around, getting excited or getting hyped by the latest tool in that sort of blockchain crypto shared ledger landscape. And, you know, this crazy stuff going on with the you know, non-fungible tokens, the NFTs being attached to works of art is a whole speculative bubble. I was actually on an auction house conference call on Friday, I think it was, and the purpose of the call was to describe the NFT landscape and who was doing what and how it all worked. And I was very hopeful that I would learn something that would be useful. But what I found was a profound lack of leadership, insight, and certainty. So it feels very, very frothy, very unreliable. And, you know, the thing about blockchains and provenance, that's like an administrative tool. And administrative tools don't drive markets, you know. Transaction vehicles drive markets. So I think that type of, you know, I would separate them into two landscapes. Are you talking about transactional things that help people facilitate investments or buying and selling art? Or are you talking about things that are administrative in nature? And so many of these things are really administrative in nature. And until there's a use case that's so compelling that, you know, a global auction house or a global luxury provider or a major gallery adopts them, then, you know, it's just all sort of nonsense.
Right. So there's no real early leader that you would say, well, you know, those, that these guys, this technology, you know, they may be interesting to watch out for.
Not at all. Yeah. And, you know, the other nut to crack is using artificial intelligence to do valuation assessments. And there are companies out there that are attempting to do this. And I have found them to be curious and interesting, anecdotally on target from time to time, but not reliable. I'm not going to allocate my capital to Alexander Calder or Saul LeWitt or Donald Judd or Andy Warhol based upon what their valuation models are telling me, because, again, it still doesn't account for the lack of transparency and disclosure, the lack of private transaction records and things like that, that you really need to understand value.
Right. So how do you value artwork, right? You personally?
Well, you know, I think that I start with this notion of looking at public auction records and what the public retail pricing is for similar works. I look at the secondary market valuation of works. So, you know, going back to that example where you have 800 collectors for every 20 artworks made, you know, with a hot artist, you know, what happens in the secondary market is that those prices get run up dramatically. So I look at auction records, I look at primary market, meaning the original gallery and how it prices the works. I look at the secondary market and what the landscape of a broader collectors are willing to pay up for that artwork. And then you look, as I said before, you compare the artist to its peers. You look at the work in the context of the artist's body of work, a whole host of different things. You also look at the quality of the work. You know, let's not also forget that this is an asset class that has a high degree of subjective interpretation of the value. Again, like a lot of securities. And, you know, there are great Picassos and there are terrible Picassos. And, you know, the great Picassos will always sell and always sell well. The bad ones cannot sell, can flounder, can be undervalued, et cetera. So there's also this subjective aspect of, is this artistically a rigorous, you know, piece of work?
Right. So, Jim, this was really a fantastic education about art investing. So before we close, last question, did we miss anything? Anything you think that's important to share? Or we made the best use of our time today?
Well, no, I mean, I the only other thing that I would mention is sort of describing the landscape, you know, in a very explicit way, because understanding the ecosystem, I think, is important. You know, obviously you begin and end with the artist and then the collector base, and collectors access the artists via seeing the work in museums, seeing the work in galleries, at auction, through private dealers and online platforms. So there, I just wanted to sort of round out the discussion by saying that there are lots of different ways in which one can engage with the art world. And it can be through, you know, participants like galleries or just through auction houses or relying on a private dealer or an art advisor. And these are all, you know, viable tools, but, you know, sort of looking at the full group of them is always important to keep in mind.
Right. Okay. So we'll keep that in mind. Let me close the session today. This was, again, as I said, a fantastic education. Thank you so much, Jim, for making time today. I will put
thank
the podcast up probably tomorrow. So make sure to share the podcast with all your fans and friends, Jim. And I hope to see you soon again live somewhere on the planet. Right. Thank you all for joining. Please come back for our next session here on Clubhouse. We'll actually have one on family offices on Wednesday. You will see the details in the Family Office Club under my profile on Clubhouse. Thank you. All the best. And bye-bye. Take care. Bye, Jimmy.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
And that was it for today's podcast version of the Alternative Investments Show. Thank you for joining and subscribing to our service. You can always email me at nab@opales.com. Also, if you're interested in joining our show as a guest. If you liked what you heard and want to support us, please write a review to help others discovering the service.